or similar device, would you please turn it off so that the lawyers aren't interrupted?
Good afternoon. Jack Sperber appearing on behalf of the Sinclair appellants. This is a case in which Commerce City seeks to annex large chunks of land against the will of its owners by using long, narrow strips to encircle the properties and to artificially create an enclave in direct contravention of the legislature's intent in adopting CRS 3112-106-1.1A. And there's got to be a sense of deja vu for those who've been around long enough to remember, because this is precisely the type of activity that Commerce City was engaged in back in the late 70s and early 80s, and it was precisely those activities that led the legislature in 1981 to adopt the amendments that are at issue in this appeal, using broad language precluding the use of public rights of way, including streets and alleys, to artificially encircle properties and involuntarily annex them.
Is there any reference in the legislative history to railroad rights of way?
There is not in the legislative transcripts, Your Honor. There is in the newspaper articles, which of course are contemporaneous history that the legislature is presumed to have knowledge of. There's discussion that the city is primarily using city streets or other streets, but there's also references to a 7,000-foot-long strip of Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad right-of-way that was at least being considered for annexation at that time. And I think if you understand that, that was something that the legislature knew was being used, and you understand the harm that the legislature was trying to prevent here, which is essentially shortcuts. If you understand the context of the Annexation Act, every other provision in the Annexation Act that allows for the annexation of property requires the consent of the owners in some form, either through the filing of a petition for annexation or through an election where a majority of the owners agree to that. Enclave annexations are different. They're unique in that they allow the involuntarily annexation of areas that are truly islands surrounded by the city. And so the legislature allows for that under Section 1 of 106. But 1.1A, which was adopted in 1981 in response to the city's actions, puts some limitations on that. And if you look at the legislative history, you'll see that both the legislature itself and the Colorado Municipal League, which advocates on behalf of cities in this state, condemned the practices. And the CML representative indicated that the purpose of the amendment was to allow for the annexation of true enclaves, which she defined as islands within the city, completely surrounded, but to prohibit the involuntary annexation where it's not surrounded and instead is using a public right-of-way to accomplish that fact. So when you understand that purpose, it defies logic to think that the legislature would have excluded railroads from their definition of public right-of-way.
Is there a tension between what you're discussing and the policy that the act be treated liberally to encourage the natural and well-ordered development of municipalities?
I don't think there is, Your Honor. I do agree that it is to be construed liberally and to accomplish the well-orderly growth of that. But again, the enclave annexation provisions deal with a slightly different situation where you're involuntarily annexing areas. And I think if you liberally construe those provisions to deal with the legislative harm that was trying to be prevented, that's very consistent with our position that you should construe the term public right-of-way very liberally and broadly. I think you can think of the issue this way. If Commerce City had come in front of the legislature in 1981 and said, gosh, we know that you don't like us using these city streets to encircle these properties and create involuntary annexations, but you're all right with us using railroad rights of way, aren't you? I think we all know what the answer to that question would have been.
Well, I'm not sure we do. Are there any reasons why a city might choose to annex a railroad right of way other than as an artifice to create enclaves?
Well, I think there's plenty of reasons that they might consider annexing railroad rights of way, and I think there's plenty of reasons why they may annex other properties. I think, again, the purpose, Your Honor, that they were trying to prevent was a shortcut process. And so one of the justifications that the city gave back in the early 1980s for using this right of way was that it wasn't designed to create this artificial enclave, but it was essentially a flagpole annexation. They were trying to get to a property owner who had consented, wanted to be annexed, and they were using long right-of-way to get there. So they were negotiating and reaching an agreement with one owner. There's functionally no difference between that and reaching an agreement with a long, narrow right-of-way owner like a railroad or like a utility easement or somebody else. You've got to get the consent of somebody, but it doesn't require the overall consent that the Annexation Act normally contemplates, either, again, through getting all of the owners in the area to consent to that or building up enough of a consensus that there is truly an island surrounding a piece of property within a city where that consensus has already been built up.
Is there any evidence in the record as to why exactly the city annexed the railroad right-of-way at issue in this case?
I am not aware of any evidence in the record. There's some discussion in one of the newspaper articles that is cited as part of the record that there was an initial attempt to annex that. There was some litigation. That piece of the lawsuit was ultimately dismissed, and then a couple years later, there was discussions again with Burlington Northern to annex it. But I don't recall, at least, Your Honor, any specific reason for why they were doing that.
Thank you.
I want to spend just a minute, if I can, on the standard of review issue, because I think there's been a lot of confusion in the briefs on this, and I think, again, part of that turns upon what you're looking at. The city points to general law and statutory provisions relating to review proceedings under the Annexation Act, and those are generally very deferential to the city. But again, all of those circumstances arise in a different context where parties have consented to the annexation. There's essentially a marriage, a meeting of the minds or a marriage, and the parties that are complaining are traditionally third parties who aren't happy with that marriage, where it's a city, another city, or a county, or other owners. And in those contexts, review proceedings have been pretty deferential. Again, in the enclave annexation provisions, it's an involuntary annexation, and in adopting the amendments in 1981, the legislature laid out some very specific standards. And so 116.3, which was relied upon by the city and ultimately by the trial court, allows for this abuse of discretion or exceeded jurisdiction standard. 116.2, which was adopted at the same time as the statute we've been talking about, gives the trial court the ability to review enclave annexation proceedings, asks the trial court to determine whether public right-of-way is involved, and mandates that if public right-of-way is involved, it shall declare the annexation void.
But there's no factual dispute. Isn't this quite simply a question of whether we should interpret public right-of-way as used in the exception to include a railroad right-of-way?
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. And I think that's one of the errors that occurred below, is that this is truly an issue of statutory interpretation, which requires de novo review by the trial courts and ultimately by this court. And I think what happened below is that the city council kind of supplanted that role, reached a conclusion for itself that railroad rights of way are not public rights of way within the meaning of the act. Then when it got to the trial court, rather than the trial court engaging in a de novo review and reaching for itself a conclusion about what the statute means, it applied this abuse of discretion standard. And it combed the record to try to find any evidence that could support an argument that this was private right-of-way, pointed to a couple of little snippets in the testimony from the city engineer and I believe the city manager, and said, well, that's some evidence that somebody could have relied upon, and applying the abuse of discretion standard upheld it. So nobody has actually reviewed the statute and determined whether public right-of-way includes railroad rights-of-way within the meaning of the act.
So where do we go for guidance on that? The U.S. Supreme Court's Donovan decision?
I think you don't have to go that far, Your Honor. I think, again, you should look first at the legislative purposes and legislative history here, which indicates the harm that was trying to be prevented. When you understand that, I think it leads you to a conclusion that they want the broadest term possible. I think, you know, the parties frankly got down in the weeds in terms of arguing various definitions for public, various modifiers to the term right-of-way. Case law that says that railroads have both public and private attributes. I think we win that argument down in the weeds, but I think you don't need to go there. I think if you look at the harm that was trying to be prevented, public needs to be interpreted very broadly to mean any long, narrow strip of right-of-way that is imbued with a public purpose. And when you think about it from a practical standpoint, the only entities that control these long, narrow strips of right-of-way that could be used to create these things on a shortcut basis are entities that have condemnation powers. Despite being private owners of property, railroads, energy companies, electric transmission lines, all have eminent domain powers in recognition of the public purposes that they serve. And I think that's the guidance that you need to interpret the statute.
Pardon me, Mr. Sperber, I'd like to ask you a question about that, because let's say we do want to get down in the weeds, just for purposes of argument.
Sure.
You mentioned a couple things that I need some help with. This property is not owned by the city, it's owned by the railroad. I'm assuming the railroad pays taxes, and I'm assuming that if there were to be trespass actions brought, it would be the railroad, not the city, doing that. In light of that, which seems to me on its face to appear to be a privately owned piece of property, I want you to help me with your argument about why this is public, okay?
Sure. First, I don't think there's anything in the statute which suggests that ownership is the test. And again, if you look at the legislative history behind that, there's no discussion about the definition of this or a centering on ownership, or certainly not city ownership. Lots of rights of way that serve public purposes can't meet the definitions that the city talked about. City property itself can be controlled both in terms of access and in terms of requiring compensation or in terms of protecting itself from condemnation. So there's functionally very little difference between that and railroad rights of way or other forms of public rights of way. I think one last piece of guidance on this down in the weeds is the fact that our legislature, dating back to our Constitution, has recognized that railroads are public highways and public ways. Both our Constitution did that in its inception. In 2002, as part of legislative declarations, they again recognized in amending public utility statutes that railroads are public highways. And then a specific statute, I believe it's 3712-102, that's cited in our briefs, there's a definition giving special districts the ability to condemn a variety of interests, including easements, railroad rights of way, and other public ways, again suggesting that the legislature understands railroads to be public ways. I'd like to reserve the remainder of our time if you don't have other questions.
Good afternoon, Tom Merrigan, registration 7874, on behalf of the City of Commerce City. This case is deceptively simple and straightforward. There's no legitimate dispute that Commerce City did everything right in annexing this enclave. It dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. That's why the appellant's only argument is this specious public right-of-way argument, which finds no support in the facts that are contained in the record, nor in the statutory interpretations and statutory definitions propounded by the legislature since the Constitution of the state was enacted back in 1876 and said at that time that railroads were public rights of way, referring clearly based on the case law to the public use of railroads and the need for the government to regulate railroads in some areas. However, this question of whether railroads are the railroad rights of way in this case are public or private rights of way is, in our view, a mixed question of law and fact. That is, the fact that the railroads are privately owned, the fact that they control access and that the public is not permitted to access the railroads, those facts bear on this court's decision as to whether they are public rights of way or not.
Well, are you suggesting that in one case, based on these sorts of facts, a court could find that a railroad right of way is public, and on some other set of facts, it could find it's private? Because it seems to me it makes more sense to look at it as a matter of statutory interpretation, and either the statutory language includes railroad rights-of-way or it doesn't?
Well, I agree that it is primarily a question of statutory interpretation. However, I could envision a case where the railroad had a lesser property interest than the railroads in this case, and that might make a difference. I also think the court needs to be mindful of the ramifications of a ruling that every railroad right-of-way in the state of Colorado is public. I don't represent the railroads, but I know that they would not be happy to learn that. Even if you leave it in the context of the annexation statutes, railroads have a right if their property is subject to an annexation, to agree or not agree, to vote or not vote in favor of an annexation, because they are private property owners. If this court rules that their rights of way are public, I would submit that that casts some doubt on their ability, at least under the annexation statutes, to have one of the incidents of private property ownership, and that is a say in whether or not they're annexed into a municipality. Now, you asked about whether or not there was any evidence in the record about how these railroads came to be annexed. The evidence in the record consists of the annexation maps and the annexation ordinances by which these railroads were annexed into Commerce City.
Well, the sense of my question was whether anybody went back one step further and got the transcripts of the hearings before the city where these railroads were annexed and looked for reasons whether this was just a contrivance to create enclaves or where there were other more legitimate reasons. Do you agree with your opponent's statement that there is no such evidence in the record?
Well, the best evidence, frankly, would have been the petitions for annexation involved in the annexations that annexed the railroad property. Sure. And the railroad signature on those petitions. That is not contained in the record. However, there's only three ways you can annex property. One is an enclave, one is a vote, and one is a voluntary annexation. There's no evidence that there was anything other than a voluntary annexation.
No, the sense of my question isn't the process. The sense of my question is the city's underlying rationale in doing so, and the record is silent on that.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Council, you indicated that you thought that your counterpart's argument was specious, and I take it that that goes in part to your attorney's fees argument.
Yeah.
But the Colorado Constitution does say that all railroads shall be public highways, and I'm not aware of a Colorado appellate case that's applied that provision in any context. Are you?
I'm certainly not aware of one that applies it in the context of private property rights to characterize the right that the railroad has in their land as public. So
it would be an issue of first impression.
I think so, and as I indicated earlier, I think it would be, there might be some significant unintended consequences if this court were to rule that in all cases, railroad rights of way in Colorado is a public right of way. I would like to briefly address, if I could, the Birch plaintiff's argument on AN 5785, the contiguity question that they attempt to raise. The city's position on that is that there is absolutely no evidence in the record considered by the city which would put into play what is essentially a math problem that was attached to the Birch plaintiff's brief in the trial court, and that's the first time that math problem appeared in this case. And they basically asked the trial court and now seem to be asking this court to get out a calculator and perform an exercise to see whether or not their math is correct.
Well, let me tell you, we have done that, and it looks like their math is correct.
Well,
because the maps indicate that the contiguous border is marked in a crosshatch. And,
right.
You know, we've added that up, and it's about 100 feet short of the calculated 1/6 requirement. Now, I don't necessarily ask you to agree with that, but let's assume that we come to that conclusion. What
all
should
right.
we do?
Well, then what I can tell you is in the record is, first of all, Janelle Lund, the registered and licensed surveyor who contemporaneously with the preparation of the annexation map certified that she did the math, and that the contiguity requirement was met. That's in the record on the AN 5785 annexation map. And then flash forward to 2007, when these hearings were held, Christine Sievem, a licensed professional engineer employed by the city, submitted an affidavit, which was entered into the record, which indicated that she checked the contiguity calculations for all of the underlying annexations in this case, and that the all of the underlying annexations, including AN 5785, met the contiguity requirement. That is in the record. And so, therefore, it is entitled to a presumption of regularity and validity. And I would submit that's a done deal. That whether or not the math that they're suggesting should be followed is appropriate is not. There is overwhelming evidence in the record from people whose job it is to do that, that the contiguity requirements were met, and the city reasonably and legally relied upon those determinations in the record.
Mr. Murrigan, if I could ask about the affidavits. Were those affidavits based upon independent surveying and counting, or were those affidavits based upon looking at the same documents that we have and engaging in the same math process that we've engaged in?
You know, all I can say to that, Your Honor, is that Ms. Sievem is a licensed professional engineer. Part of her job is to assist the city in reviewing annexations, and I assume that she did whatever due diligence she felt necessary, because I've worked with her, and she doesn't make guesses about things. You know, you don't ask an engineer for a ballpark figure. They get kind of funny. She actually did the math and did the review that she said she did. As to exactly what she did, I couldn't say.
Well, let me come back to my question, and I'm not asking you to concede the factual predicate for your argument. But if we conclude that the map doesn't get to the 9,089 feet required, do we remand to the district court, to remand to the city to take further evidence, to make more specific findings? What's your suggested solution if we find that's a problem?
Well, my suggested solution would be that you rule in favor of the city, because the overwhelming evidence in the record, other than those calculations, substantiates the result, the conclusion reached by the city, that the contiguity requirement is met. If you determine that that's a basis for overturning the district court decision, then I suppose a remand might be the most appropriate way to go.
Thank you.
Finally, I'd like to return just briefly to the statutory analysis on the public highway discussion. If you look at 3112.104, you'll see that the legislature used the term public or private right-of-way and public or private transportation right-of-way. Clearly, the legislature was aware in the annexation context of the available descriptors that it could use when it was delineating the annexation process. And contrary to the argument made by Mr. Sperber, there is no special scrutiny that is given to enclave annexations under any of the statutes as opposed to any other kind of annexation. You take an appeal under 116, which is basically a 106 action with two procedural variants, and that is that you get 60 days to file it, and that you must jurisdictionally file a motion for reconsideration before you can file it. So I would submit that all of the statutory interpretation arguments, the in-the-weeds discussion that you had earlier, in fact favor the City of Commerce City in this case.
One question. In terms of your attorney fees claim,
yes.
Since the phrase public right-of-way is not defined in the exception. And how could we conclude that the trial court abused its discretion in declining to award fees?
I'm not sure that you really can. I think that there is it's discretionary with the trial court, and I'm not going to say that it isn't, Your Honor. I just think that this argument that is being propounded is not substantiated factually or legally for the reasons that I've discussed this afternoon. And for that reason, the court should have awarded attorney's fees.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, my name is John Zackham, and I represent Birch Appellants. And I'd just like to take a few moments to address some of the issues that counsel brought up in his response argument and jump back to some of the questions I think that the court addressed to Mr. Sperber. First, and I think most importantly, is to verify to the court that we're not asking for a very broad and expansive holding with respect to the definition of what is a public right-of-way. Counsel argued that we may be facing a slippery slope type of analysis if you were to hold that railroads are public right-of-ways in general. Specifically, what the appellants are asking for here is for the court to determine as a matter of law that railroads constitute public rights-of-way for purposes of subsection 1.1's prohibition against the use of long strips of land to create boundaries for involuntary annexation. And we think that a proper limited finding on that aspect of the law would be appropriate in this case. Secondly, the court did note, I think it was you, Judge Roman, that this is a matter of first impression. We couldn't find ourselves whether or not there was any case interpreting the prohibitive provisions of the unilateral annexation, enclave annexation provisions enacted in 1981. I think it's very important for this court to take note of that, specifically the fact that this is the first opportunity for the court to interpret those prohibitions and recognize the fact that the reason they were placed in there is to provide that check on government. You judges clearly pointed out in opposing counsel's arguments the fact that most of the evidence that's relied upon in the context of proceeding with an enclave annexation is brought by people working for the city government, the municipality seeking to impose an involuntary annexation. Well, there's got to be some check and balance here, and what is normally in place for the other avenues for annexation, which is a vote of the people or an agreement, as Mr. Sperber put it, a marriage, voluntary annexation. Here we've got involuntary annexation of citizens' properties and business properties. They're going to be taxed regardless of whether or not that annexation is overturned. The harm is being done. What you folks are here to do is afford the check and balance on government's actions in this context, and this is the only way in which you can do it, by invoking your ability under section 116.2b to specifically review the enclave annexations and whether or not they're justified in light of the constitutional mandates and the prohibitions under subsection 1.1. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. As soon as the tables are cleared and our spectators, if they are not interested in the second case, are welcome to leave. We'll take argument in Corey versus Escajeda.